From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Pete Stoughton, sitting in for Tim Henney.
Well, it may be hard to believe that in the 19th century, formaldehyde was placed in milk to, well, preserve it. It actually was, and it killed scores of children, even thousands, from this chemically, quote-unquote, improved milk. And that's not all, as our guest Pulitzer Prize winner Deborah Bloom tells us. Now, the industrialization of food production was all the rage, and meanwhile, Americans were paying the price, being poisoned regularly, from butter being made edible with borax and coffee containing sawdust dyed dark with lead-based dye. Deborah Bloom joins us by phone to explore her new book, The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Crusade for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century. Deborah Bloom, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Wow, what a book you have put together here. And I just have to say, reading through some of these accounts that took place in the mid-late 1800s and into the 1900s actually makes me feel like it's still going on, however, a less blatant sort of way that we're being poisoned by our food.
Yeah, I think that's right. And one of the things that I hadn't expected, I started this book thinking I'm going to tell this amazing forgotten history. And then as I got further into it, I thought, this is really a cautionary tale for today, because we're looking both at, the 19th century was an unregulated, crazy bad landscape of food, which we don't have today, so we're ahead of that. But some of the forces that came to play, the pushback by industry on regulation, the relationship between our federal government and major American business that allowed corruption of the regulations, right? The questions we still have about the safety of the food supply and how we best protect it, all of that resonates and is actually connected to this story of the first fight for consumer protection in the United States.
Yeah. Well, going back then, you can tell many tens, scores of different stories, but let's start with something as egregious as formaldehyde in milk. I mean, that sounds crazy to us now, but it probably started with some good intention, preservation of milk.
That's exactly right. And formaldehyde and milk are one of my favorite stories in the book because it opens up so many issues of what was going on. So milk in the 19th century, was famously dangerous for a whole lot of reasons. This is before pasteurization, so you have a lot of germs of, from tuberculosis to other horrible diseases of the 19th century that grow in milk. It's a good medium for bacteria. There's no refrigeration. The American dairy industry, intent on profit, is busy, I'm going to put air quotes around this if you could see me in my office, improving milk to make it more profitable. So you have, they'll take basic milk, they'll thin it with water. That was very standard. There's actually recipes for milk thinning that were shared by dairymen. They then recolor it. It'd be kind of grayish blue with chalk or plaster. If they wanted to look a little creamier, they'd add a synthetic dye of some kind of yellow, which was sometimes a lead-based dye. They'd fake the cream. This can get really disgusting, but in some states they would puree calf brains to make a kind of creamy layer that floated on top of the milk.
Oh, man, I'm really thankful my mom didn't pass down that recipe to me as a child. Goodness. Well, you mentioned this
and
is one of your
they
favorites.
Preserve it with formaldehyde.
Right. You mentioned this is one of your favorite stories in the book. What is your favorite one that you like to reflect in and share?
Well, it's hard to top milk, but I think because for me, for all the mix of horrible ingredients, but I tended to obsess about coffee because I'm non-functional without coffee in the morning. So Coffee is a great example, not so much of dangerous things like formaldehyde, but just the incredible inventive range of 19th century fraud. So when chemists first started testing the ingredients in coffee, quite often there was, you know, a minimal amount of caffeine-rich coffee grains in there, but there would be everything from charred bone to sawdust dyed dark with lead black to sometimes charred rope went into it, right? And then as people, there's rumors, oh, my coffee is not really waking me up. I'll get coffee beans. There's a cottage industry of making fake coffee beans, which were mixed into the real coffee beans. And so there's a whole business of making coffee bean molds that are filled with wax and dirt or sometimes just clay. There was, I was reading a 19th century physician speculating that the phrase a muddy cup of coffee came from the fact that there was so much mud in the coffee. And I actually started wondering, what did 19th century coffee taste like, right? It was full of so many things that weren't coffee. I mean, what were people actually drinking? So you look back at this period of I can put anything in it and get away with it, and it's really kind of horrifying.
It does. It seems pretty scary. I'm glad that we do our own here in Park City. came back from Europe, and I noticed a lot of the coffee there was machine. And it made me think of, is that still something with coffee and with other products, that there's a margin of error accepted in the products that we buy? Do you find that still is the case?
By margin of error, you mean?
Allowances.
Yes, there are definitely allowances. And again, this dates back to, at least in the United States, you see this laid down in the early 20th century when we're first actually putting in place some kind of minimal regulations, and there's a kind of hand-holding dance between government and industry as to what the regulations will be and, you know, how much they will infringe on the American right to make a big profit, which was, came up because up until we started consumer protection regulations, the 1906 Food and Drug Act was the first, it was unfettered profit. So there was a lot of concern by government leaders, fed by concerned industry leaders, that this was going to infringe on that. So just to give you one example, I think of sort of the allowance we see today, you will sometimes see on your food label cellulose. It's a stabilizer or an extender. I mean, it's not defined on the label, but it tends to be do that, right? What is cellulose? It's usually wood pulp. So, but we don't tell the consumer, the person who's buying the food, me, who's buying the food, that I'm eating wood pulp, and we're completely nonspecific about it, right? Am I eating oak? Am I eating pine? Am I eating birch? I mean, what is actually in my product here? And that is, in fact, reflects back to this, the kind of compromises that were put in place. We're going to do labels, but how transparent do those labels have to be, right? And so I think, you know, when everyone says, oh, be an informed consumer, one of the consequences is that, you know, sometimes it's a lot of work, more work than an individual can be expected to do to be fully informed.
Right, because it's not just enough to read the ingredient list, like you say. Even though we have them listed, there's lots of subtleties that if you're not fully informed, you'll miss a whole lot of things, like if you're eating pine or oak or willow. So let's talk.
I'm very curious about that.
Yeah. Let's talk about this chemistry professor who really changed everything, Dr. Harvey Washington Wiley. So he's named the chief chemist of the U.S. Agriculture Department. And boy, they don't know what they've got coming to them when he steps onto the stage.
That's a great way of putting it, and they did not know. He was an Indiana farm boy. He'd been a professor at Purdue. He'd trained in med school in Indiana and chemistry at Harvard, and he looked like an innocuous chemistry professor. And then he gets to Washington, D.C. in 1883, and he's chief of the Bureau of Chemistry in the Department of Agriculture, which is the agency responsible for food safety at that point. And what I think no one really appreciated is how much this idea that the consumers came first and chemistry had to be a science in the service of good infused the way he thought about his science. So from the day almost that he gets there, he launches the government into investigating food safety in the U.S. And so a lot of the things we were just talking about, the frauds and the fakery, come out of this tiny bureau and start immediately alarming businesses across the country. What is going on here? And you start to see he keeps putting out this information, and you start to see even business campaigns to discredit him early on. He immediately alarmed people who thought he was going to be, you know, more harmless.
Yeah. So I'm wondering about this thing that may be called human nature, but it's always been unbelievable to me that people who are the very ones who are putting mixing borax with butter to make it edible, are they looking the other way? Are they not eating it? Or are they saying, like many of us do, like, oh, I can't really taste it, and so it must not really be there, and therefore I'm going to continue eating it, you know, much like we continue to eat, you know, cheesy Doritos, even though it's mostly made up of chemicals.
Right, not necessarily that good for us. I think when you're, so if I go back in the 19th century, right, I think it's a mix of two things. One is people legitimately did not know how bad some of these things were. With something like formaldehyde, it was kind of hard to ignore because kids kept getting sick. But with something like borax, it would be a more subtle effect. And so the day that you said, hey, my stomach's a little bit off today, because without knowing it, you'd had borax in your butter and borax in your soup and borax and many other food products during that day, you wouldn't necessarily connect those dots. And partly if you were a consumer, because there's nothing on the label, or if you were a businessman, because you had enough money to buy better stuff, right? And you really see this highly manufactured food targeting particularly blue-collar workers, right? They don't have enough money to buy the good stuff, so they're buying this, you know, food that often really is fraudulent. And so some of it is lack of knowledge then, and some of it is a deliberate decision to look the other way, because formaldehyde stays in the food supply even after children have there's been scandals in places like Indianapolis where children died from drinking formaldehyde-laced milk. And no one gives it up because it's not illegal. And it doesn't come out of the food supply until the law goes into effect. So there we see people, I think, really being bad actors. They know it's dangerous, but it's so handy and profitable, they look the other way. And that marches with people who really don't know, which is one of the reasons that Wiley, my chemist, eventually starts saying, well, how bad is this, and running some tests on human volunteers.
This seems to be echoing and foreshadowing to our current situation here in the U.S. when people talk about disparity of income and food supply. If Dr. Wiley was still alive, what would he be passionate about in our current health crisis and food supplies?
That's a great question. I mean, my guess is he'd be dissatisfied. He certainly was dissatisfied with the rigorousness of investigations and the failure of government, I think, to hold business to account. At his time, I think he would take up that issue we were just discussing of honest and transparent labels and would push again to see those be better. And I think he would plant his feet on the fact that we're not doing the kind of safety testing and proactive steps that we probably should be. You mentioned going to Europe. There are about 1,000 compounds that are in American diets in different forms, from pesticides to additives. that are banned in Europe and permitted in the U.S. And so I think Harvey Wiley would like for us to take a really serious look at those compounds and say, why are we allowing our citizens to be exposed to these when other countries find them dangerous? Let's do the needed safety testing. We have the apparatus in place. We just don't fund it. So we need to put more money into really proactively protecting food and do that in a very public way. Because I have yet, since I've started talking to books, about this book, talk to anyone who says to me, oh, no, I have complete faith in the American food supply. Usually, instead, people ask me what I don't eat, right? So I'm really picking up on the fact that just as in 100 years ago people didn't trust the food supply, we don't trust it now.
I think, pretty common in the culture, and so I think your book will resonate with many people. My last question is I was captivated not only by your book, but also just the way that you spoke. And I've worked with and spoken with a lot of scientists, and you are way too captivating for a scientist and way too knowledgeable for a writer. So where do you fall? Do you feel like you're more of a writer or a scientist if you were to be on that spectrum there?
So I'm a fail. I'm the daughter of the scientist and myself a failed chemist. I started out as a chemistry major, and I studied chemistry on and off in both undergrad and grad, but I didn't pursue a chemistry degree. So I see myself as a science writer with some background in science, but I also, and I think you're probably picking this up in this conversation, because of the way I grew up, you know, in a science house, as it were. I see science as really human. There are you know, scientists are people trying to understand the world around us. They make human errors. They're prickly and difficult, as, you know, Harvey Wiley could be. And I think it's really important to have people have that comfort level with science. It's part of our life. It walks with us every day. It helps us navigate the world. So, you know, you're probably picking up on all of those things. I'm glad they come across well. Thank you.
They do, indeed. If you're just joining us, our guest is Deborah Bloom. She is a Pulitzer Prize winner. She's written a handful of books. She's written for publications like the New York Times, Wired, Time, Discover, Mother Jones. Wow, you have an impressive resume. In addition to being the past president of the National Association of Science Writers. So there you go, Pete. Yeah. So her book is The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Crusade for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century. And of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you about this poison squad. And there were people who actually tested some of these poisoned foods. So talk about the poison squad.
It's kind of a crazy and wonderful story, right? You could never do this experiment today. But eventually, after about 20 years of saying unsafe food, food regulation now, and failing on that, Wiley finally says, well, okay, we're putting all of these things in the food supply. Let's actually try to find out if they're safe in some kind of meaningful way. And he skips animal testing and goes right to people, which is the crazy part. And he starts this experiment in which he recruits volunteers. They were young government underpaid employees to be part of this experiment, in which the deal is they can get 3 free meals a day. Wonderful farm fresh food, actually was farm fresh food, beautifully cooked by a professional chef. But they have to agree that at any given moment in these experiments, half of them will be adding capsules containing a food additive like formaldehyde or borax or salicylic acid or copper sulfate, which was a toxic metal used to green vegetables. And they just sign up in droves. That's the other thing that wouldn't happen today. There's so little awareness of how dangerous this is. Mm-hmm. The people are writing from across the country. I have a cast iron stomach. Sign me up now. Mm-hmm. So he gets this group of young men, and he starts feeding them these regular food additives. And to his surprise, even, they get really sick, right? And so that does two things. It shocks him and makes him even more of a crusader, and it catches the attention of American newspapers. The Washington Post is responsible for calling it the Poison Squad. He called it something more sedate. And so now across the country, people are reading on the front page about these really bad things that are going into their food, and that actually is kind of a tipping point. It starts driving a national conversation on are we being irresponsible if we don't do something about this?
Hey, there's one nice thing that I have to say before we let you go, and unfortunately we're out of time, but it was good to know that Henry Heinz, as in Heinz Ketchup, was one of those pioneers in saying, hey, we want to make some corrections and put good food in our good food, lack of poison. We want to take the poison out of our food. But still, I think there's pretty hefty amounts of corn syrup in Heinz ketchup.
Yes, and they didn't used to be back in the day. You know, I have a kind of fangirl thing going about Henry Heinz, which sounds kind of creepy for a guy who's been gone a long time, but he really did stand up. He was the head of a major food processing company, but he actively worked to get preservatives out of his ketchup before the government required it. And at his time, he didn't use corn syrup. You know, you can go back and see Heinz advertisements of the time, and they'll literally say the only condiment approved by the Bureau of Chemistry, or is your vinegar really pure? And he just thought he actually, like Harvey Wiley, had a sort of moral upbringing, so that even though he could be a really ruthless businessman, he also just said, here's my line, I want my food to be safe and healthy, and I admire that.
The book is The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Crusade for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century. Our guest is Deborah Bloom. Deborah, thank you. This is a really interesting book and great conversation.
Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful talking to you, and I really appreciate you having me on.
All right. Take care.